You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
I don't usually do sermons at weddings. Most people just want to get through the vows, sign the license, and get on to the reception. On the whole, I think the average wedding sermon is usually counterproductive, especially the one I did a number of years ago out at the Luke Air Force Base Chapel. As this was a wedding of two of my former spouse's co-workers, virtually everyone in the congregation was either an accountant or a CPA. And the couple themselves wanted to get their money's worth out of the pastor, so they insisted on me doing a sermon. But in an unusual twist, they chose the passage for me to preach on. And it's our passage for today, on forgiveness. Now, from experience, my then spouse had always encouraged me not to do math in public. But no, here I am saying to a room full of math nerds, Jesus said, forgive one another 70 times, 7 times. That's like, wow, 140 times. Let's just say there were no small number of snorts and guffaws in the congregation. And the bride, now not so sure about the efficacy of any sermon I was about to deliver, encouraged me to just get on with it. But in my own defense, I think I at least caught the spirit of Jesus' message, if not the correct total. In our text today, Jesus is basically saying, just forgive and don't keep count of the cost. The person who counts has not forgiven at all, but is only biding their time for some sort of payback. The kind of forgiveness Jesus calls for is beyond arithmetic. When Peter asked, should I forgive as many as 7 times? He thought he was being really clever and super generous because everyone knew that the rabbis at the time taught that you should forgive 3 times. You can find hints of that in Amos and other places. So I'm sure Peter thought Jesus would be impressed with his quick-wittedness by offering to forgive what was considered in Greek culture to be the perfect number of times, 7. But Jesus isn't about perfection. He's not about following a strict set of transactional rules by which you can prove your purity and righteousness. I reckon he must have smiled at Peter and spoken like you do to anyone who is well-intentioned but still clueless. No, Peter, you've still got your calculator out. Put it away.
Our words of wisdom are from Matthew chapter 18, verses 21 and 22.
Then Peter came up and said to him, Lord, how often shall my brother sin against me, and I forgive him? As many as 7 times?
Jesus said to him, I do not say to you 7 times, but 70 times 7.
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
For most listeners in the first century, and certainly in our time, this teaching sounds patently absurd in its pie-in-the-sky vagueness. Forgive? What are you talking about? In personal relationships, our political enemies and national adversaries? You'd better not be talking about money, because that's a non-starter. No way! Don't be meddling with my money. Well, sorry. When you read this teaching in the context of the whole chapter, it's pretty broad, but it also unquestionably is steeped in dialogue about finances, accounts, and debt owed and not paid. And that's as good a place to begin as any. Go back with me to Jesus' day, when debt didn't just incur interest or financial penalties. If someone owed money, their family could be seized by the lender and forced to work to pay back the debt. In extreme cases, the debtor could be thrown into prison and the family outright sold into slavery to pay off what was owed. For unpaid debt, a person could be condemned to prison for life. And as you might expect, these kinds of brutal penalties with the severest punishment were aimed most frequently at the least fortunate. In other words, to Jesus' own demographic. But here's where we need to be careful. After our simple, radical teaching from Jesus, Matthew goes on to put a story into Jesus' mouth that we did not read today, in part because, as far as I'm concerned, it's total fiction. Why? Because it's nothing the real Jesus would have said. Evidently, Matthew didn't think Jesus was clear enough, and as he is wont to do, makes up a threatening story. It's an allegory about an ungrateful servant whose angry lord hands him over to the landlord to be tortured until he pays his entire debt. Matthew even puts a menacing warning into Jesus' mouth. So my heavenly Father will also do to every one of you if you do not forgive your brother or sister from your heart. Oh, yikes! Biblical scholars agree that Jesus' entreaty to forgive 70 times 7 times may be one of the few authentic sayings that actually goes back to the historic Jesus himself. It has that shocking, over-the-top, stop-keeping-score kind of quality that sounds very Jesus-y. But the long story that follows about the unforgiving servant and especially the ending where Jesus says the king commits the man to torture and that God will do the same to you if you don't forgive sounds much more like Matthew and the early church trying to reinforce the lesson than anything the real Jesus would have ever said. In short, Jesus said, forgive until you lose count. And then Matthew jumps in and screws up the whole thing by having Jesus say, but God keeps count, so watch out. Whoops. Conflicting message. In this kind of situation, I like to go with Jesus' words rather than Matthew's enhancement. But alas, a lot of conventional or good Christians prefer Matthew. Their whole faith depends on the Deuteronomic code that says people are going to get what they deserve and deserve what they get. That's why the fantasy idea of hell is so popular. Ooh, it feels so good to think that they're going to get their comeuppance, doesn't it? But if you're a bad Christian and aren't fixated on the Bible being the inerrant word of God, you can see how this is an example of Matthew coming in and totally messing up Jesus' message of radical grace. Granted, that territory is just too dangerous for some to traverse, and ironically, this is why we are often accused of not believing in the Bible, because we're reading it too closely. So, the authentic Jesus likely encouraged his hearers to practice forgiveness across the board with lavish generosity. But Matthew stepped in and couched it in the metaphor of financial debt so people had a concrete example. But broadly speaking, when someone is in our debt, financial or otherwise, we have power over them. And to forgive is to give up that power. That's what makes forgiveness of every stripe so costly. Forgiveness is costly because it requires giving up something. Taken out of the financial realm, maybe forgiveness means giving up our need to be right. Maybe it means giving up moral superiority. Maybe it means letting go of the fantasy that someday the other person will finally realize how wrong they were and come crawling back and apologize properly. Forgiveness means letting go of control and accepting that many debts in life can never really be squared. That's why the Greek word to forgive, aphiemi, means to send off, to release, to let go, to hurl away. Do you hear those verbs? Send, release, let go, hurl away. Forgiveness is not passive. It's not forgetting. It's not pretending nothing happened. Forgiveness is an active process, a conscious act of release. In fact, forgiveness is a form of giving, and it defies the arithmetic of deserving. Holocaust survivor and Nazi hunter Simon Wiesenthal once said, "Forgetting is something that time takes care of, but forgiveness is an act of volition." Forgiveness is choosing to put down the weight you've been carrying. Anne Lamott said it even more bluntly. Not forgiving is like drinking rat poison and waiting for the rat to die. So I think the first part of Jesus' teaching can be paraphrased very simply. Stop drinking the rat poison. But then we need to talk about something that often gets confused with forgiveness, and that's reconciliation. Forgiveness and reconciliation are not the same thing. Forgiveness is unilateral. You can forgive someone who never apologizes. You can forgive someone who doesn't deserve it. You can forgive someone who never even knows you forgave them. But reconciliation is bilateral. Reconciliation takes two people. Reconciliation is the full flower of forgiveness. And where forgiveness lets go of the past, reconciliation builds a future. The Greek word for reconciliation is katalage, and it literally means restoration, the overcoming of hostility, the restoration of harmony and balance. And it's where the idea of reconciling your checkbook comes from, bringing things back into balance. So, forgiveness is letting go, releasing, hurling, and reconciliation is harmonizing and restoring something that was out of balance. In short, forgiveness can happen alone, but reconciliation takes two to tango. There's a Scandinavian story about a farmer whose dog got loose, and in a tragic twist of fate, the dog killed the only daughter of a neighboring farmer. The father of the girl almost went out of his mind with grief and rage. All he could think about was revenge. As the region was stricken with famine at the time, the farmers were steadily working their way through all the food they had stored away. And as the famine continued, the neighbor whose dog had killed the girl had to start using his seed corn to keep his family alive. And everyone knew that when you start feeding your family the seed corn, you are just postponing the inevitable, ensuring your family's eventual starvation, because you'll have nothing to plant. At first, the grieving farmer reveled in his neighbor's misfortune, thinking, "Ha! They're just getting what they deserve." But then, one night, inexplicably, the grieving farmer made his way to his neighbor's field and, under the cover of darkness, used half his own seed corn to plant his neighbor's field. Later, when his family realized what he'd done with their seed, they asked him, "Why?" And he said, "I was beginning to feel the image of God in me go out. I planted corn in my neighbor's field in order to keep God alive." Resentment can do that. It eats people alive. Bitterness corrodes the soul. Grudges poison every room it enters. You don't need God to punish people who refuse to forgive. They're already punishing themselves. And here's the strange thing. Forgiveness is a gift that benefits the giver as much as the receiver. But it requires risk. It requires vulnerability. It requires putting down the calculator. It requires letting go of the need to win. It requires planting corn in your neighbor's field in the middle of the night. But make no mistake, forgiveness is not naive. Forgiveness does not mean staying in abusive situations. Forgiveness doesn't mean pretending nothing happened. Forgiveness does not mean allowing injustice to continue. There are many times, especially in situations of abuse or violence, where the most faithful thing a person can do is to leave, seek safety, create boundaries, and hold someone accountable. Forgiveness does not mean putting yourself back in harm's way. As psychologist Alice Miller wrote, "Genuine forgiveness does not deny anger, but faces it head on. Only then will the way to forgiveness be open." Or, as another writer put it, "It is not forgive and forget as if nothing happened, but forgive and go forward, building a new future." Forgiveness is not pretending the past didn't happen. Forgiveness is refusing to let the past control the future. And that's why Jesus says forgive not 7 times, not 70 times, but 70 times 7 times. In other words, until you lose count. Because the point of forgiveness is not arithmetic. The point of forgiveness is freedom. Freedom from bitterness. Freedom from resentment. Freedom from the past. Freedom to build a future. Because forgiveness keeps your heart from hardening. And reconciliation keeps the spark of the divine alive in the world. And when that happens, when forgiveness leads to reconciliation, relationships are restored, communities are healed, and the power of the Spirit is revealed. So, stop drinking the rat poison and start planting in your neighbor's fields, embracing the reality that it's not easy. But if we can be determined to be on about forgiving without keeping count, we are well on our way toward the healing path that leads to reconciliation and restoration. So remember this. Forgiveness can happen in one heart, but reconciliation only happens between two. Forgiveness is letting go. Reconciliation is rebuilding. Forgiveness is release. Reconciliation is restoration. Forgiveness may begin the healing, but reconciliation is where the music starts. And when two hearts are moved by the same music, who can resist a little tango? Be well.
Hey, if you liked what you heard today, buy me a coffee.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.